Let's charge up another episode of the Farm Middle Podcast. I want to welcome constant listeners from all corners of the map and any new ones that might be out there. I appreciate you spending 25 minutes or so with me each week. Oh, and before I forget, I'm your host, Nick Deolius. And we have what I believe to be an invigorating, thought-provoking series of connections this week. And of course, we're going to follow our far middle tradition of paying homage to and mimicking the Dr. James Burke creation on BBC TV from decades ago, that science and history docuseries known as Connections. Our sports dedication for episode 170, different from what we typically choose for dedications. Not so much an athlete this week or even an event, but instead a decision. And it's a pending decision, still in a degree of flux. One that highlights much of what is wrong with the focus and priorities of higher education these days, particularly college athletics. And it also displays the skewed decision-making when entities or organizations, when they get to make big financial decisions with other people's money, as in taxpayers' money and college students' money. Dedication comes also, I have to tell you, with very mixed emotions because it ties to my alma mater, Penn State, and its beloved football program, which I'm a lifelong fan of. But those core far middle beliefs and policy foundations, they can't be superseded by simple emotion or personal preference. Does all this pique your interest as to what we're talking about? Let's get into it. I state at the outset that big time college sports in general, they're a mess, might be facing change that manifests into existential crisis. And quickly, student athletes are getting paid, and some of them ridiculously, massively paid. And before you say, hey, that's the market, that's what the market will support, recognize it's not a freely functioning market. It's a highly subsidized market via trillions of dollars in taxpayer money. Now, tuition for regular students, that's out of control. So any subsidization of big time sports via tuition or student fees, that's going to make a painful situation even worse, whether it's direct or indirect subsidy, and including and especially if government forgives all student debt, which we all end up paying for in the end. Now, football conferences, when you look at Division I with the NCAA, they're collapsing into a small group that consists exclusively of mega programs. And even that's not a guaranteed success, with many questions and much risk facing that type of a model. It's hard to see how big-time college sports are going to make a go of it moving forward, let alone thrive. And while all that is going on, the Pennsylvania State University, Penn State, decides this is the time for a $700 million renovation, that's in quotes, for its football stadium. Penn State's board approved the $700 million project this spring, and it's going to use debt to finance the project. It's the same old blah, blah you hear for justification of these types of projects. It's necessary for the Nittany Lions to stay competitive in college football and to drive football revenue. We need to spend $700 million for new concessions and wider walkways in the stadium and luxury seating. You know, you got to keep up with the Joneses and pace in the arms race. But, you know, just maybe this arms race, it's a race to the bottom. And Penn State applies very optimistic financial forecasts for the project to justify the massive $700 million spend. But understand, no one even knows what the rules of the Division I college athletic world is going to be in the coming years. Things are changing that quickly. A very fluid environment where the current landscape, it's already rife with hemorrhaging financial losses, and the future looks even tougher and more uncertain. Worse yet, the Penn State project comes at a time when university is trying to climb out of a deficit with moves including slashing its law school budget and offering staff buyouts. Penn State's facing a severe budget pinch, and now what's it want to do? It wants to throw $700 million to upgrade its football stadium, which, by the way, is used 6 to 7 times a year. It's illogical. Two Penn State trustees voted against the renovation proposal in May, but 26 trustees voted in favor of the stadium upgrade, 26-2. Three trustees, by the way, they abstained. And I always love hearing about how three just could not bring themselves to cast a vote on this issue. If you can't vote on a $700 million decision one way or another, then why are you even a trustee? Come on. Now, I mentioned rosy forecast assumptions that the university used to justify the $700 million football stadium spend. Indeed, they are rosy. The athletic director said an upgraded stadium would bring in new ticket revenue and other cash. Penn State said it expects to cover debt payments with revenue from concessions, new suite revenue, box revenue, that type of thing. It also expects over $130 million to come in via donations through things like naming rights and I guess other forms of sponsorship. And Penn State predicts annual athletic expenses will increase over the next 30 years by only 2.5%, which, by the way, is less than half the rate that those expenses have risen in the past decade. So they're forecasting a drastic reduction in inflation with respect to their cost structure and their expenses. And the school also forecasts minimum outlays for other sports construction projects over that time, which we know that's not going to happen. They're going to expand and build facilities for other sports as well over the coming decades. And the university says that the athletic department is going to record a $44 million surplus after 30 years from the start of the completion of the renovations. Effectively, the school wants to lever way up with debt, borrowing heavily, as the future of athletics looks very cloudy and uncertain. And it's justified, the project is, to pay for itself using assumptions going 30 years out into the future that don't pass the smell test of reasonableness. Amazingly, the Penn State CFO quipped, "I feel really comfortable with what we're projecting going forward." I wouldn't, not in this environment and with those aggressive assumptions. To be fair, Penn State's one of the rare schools that doesn't rely on subsidies from the rest of the university or from student fees to pay its athletic department's bills. It covers its costs with tickets and television rights, among other sources. The athletic department broke even, spent about $200 million last year. Football, of course, is the big earner. I think it's the only one actually in the black, the only sport out of all the sports that are offered. So whatever football makes, the way to think through this would be that other sports spend, so that overall the Penn State athletic department broke even. Now, the school says the athletic department will cover all costs of the stadium renovation, and no tuition dollars or money from the state's education budget will be used for the project. And that sounds great, and it sort of fits with the athletic department being break even currently or last year. But what happens when, because of changing dynamics in D1 football and athletics, or with a downturn perhaps in Penn State football popularity, the athletic department couldn't service the debt? What happens then? School officials say that could never happen, and even if it did, athletics would borrow from the school using non-tuition, non-state education dollars. But you know what? A similar situation caused all kinds of havoc on a university, one in California. Cal Berkeley borrowed about $440 million in 2012 to renovate its football stadium. The school planned to pay for the work in part with pricier ticket plans. Does that sound familiar? But those sales stalled and other athletic expenses continued to rise. In early 2018, Berkeley agreed to take on a portion of the debt. And as a result, the university will make about half of $18 million in annual debt payments through 2031 and pay even more thereafter. And that's money that could have gone to other university priorities. Yeah, state universities playing with other people's, taxpayers and students' money, throwing $700 million to upgrade a football stadium that's used seven times a year, borrowing heavily to finance it, justifying it with rosy assumptions over 30 years that will be tough to hit, and not knowing how major D1 athletics is going to play out with all the volatility we are seeing. I am a dedicated Penn State supporter, the football program, but more importantly, the university. It served me well in life, but this decision is and would be a poor one. So hats off to the two trustees, brave enough to act rationally and vote against this proposal. Episode 170 is dedicated to them on behalf of taxpayers, students and their families, and common sense. Let's get rolling with our connections for the episode. We just covered a sports dedication in the field of higher education. That's a fitting starting point to jump to our next connection, which was a speech given by who I consider one of the most underrated presidents in history, Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge was president from 1923 till 1929, and on the 4th of July in 1924, which coincidentally was his birthday, President Coolidge gave a speech in Washington, D.C. at the Convention of the National Education Association, the NEA. And the speech is an interesting look back in time. A number of common themes that President Coolidge highlighted when it comes to public education, they remain with where we are today with public education. And I thought it would be an excellent connection to share with you. He started off the speech by recognizing that a successful nation has to have something more than just numbers and wealth in its favor, something more than just natural resources and a strong military, at least to the extent that a nation was looking to satisfy what he referenced as the longing of the soul. That something, in his view, was the ability to soundly educate its citizenry. And Coolidge applied a clever analogy early in his speech on education to make his point. He talked about how many aspects of America that make it a success are constants, things not in need of fixing or changing. They only need to be understood and recognized. He used the example of math and simple addition. You can't change those, nor should you want to. And if you ignorantly ignore math in business or life, it's going to cause problems and eventual ruin in the case of a business. In doing so would be negligent, recklessly so. Coolidge pointed out that certain American ideals, they don't need to be changed as much as they need to be understood and then properly applied. And one of the core ideals of America is that the individual, it reigns supreme. President Coolidge stated that America has been figuring out a way to provide a system of government and society which provides the individual freedom, which is essential to the nature of a human being. You can sense a little bit of minimum government and maximum governance, that theme, with what he was saying. But individual freedom, Coolidge keenly observed, requires knowledge and it requires awareness. He knew that ignorance is the greatest obstacle to freedom of the individual. And for popular government to work, as in a Republican democracy like that of the United States, you need to have an effective way of educating the citizens, and it needs to be available to all. Coolidge clearly accepted that it is business, in the end, that makes the most valuable contribution to human progress, as in the private sector, and that an individual has always been and will continue to be primarily responsible for their own livelihood and their path and their ultimate salvation, not government. Coolidge explicitly stated the government is no substitute for enterprise, and I clearly second that thought. But Coolidge makes the case for the need and the benefits of an effective public education system where government is going to play a role. And in that summer of 1924, he cited statistics whereby one out of every four persons in the United States back then, they served in some capacity directly concerned with education. So either as a pupil, administrator, or teacher. And he spoke of the enormous sums of money, even back then, that the nation was investing into education. It was north of $2 billion in 1924. And I don't even want to think about where our spending levels have reached today with education, and I might add with highly disappointing results. Coolidge saw investing taxpayer dollars into education and government involvement in ensuring an effective public education system, those things were logical, and they had the potential for strong rates of return on behalf of taxpayers. And it was developing the brain power of the country, and that would make individuals more productive, and then that would make the economy stronger. That was the logic and the rationale. I'd say about midway through his speech, President Coolidge made an astute observation. He noted that often institutions, they're going to be attacked, and they're attacked in the name of social and economic reform. That's typically the justification for change or for government intervention. But he knew that unless there was the teaching of sound economics and civics in public education and in the schools, then the voter and taxpayer would be in danger of blindly accepting vague theories and cloudy justifications for major reform or government intervention. And that could lead to potential social discontent and public disaster. In other words, ignorance is never bliss when it comes to citizens understanding what policy will sow. And another keen insight from Coolidge was noting two general categories that an individual needs to be grounded in. So first is what he referenced as trained intelligence. That's the ability to read, having math proficiency and understanding of basic science, civics, that type of thing. But then there is the as important intangibles, having morality and good character and conviction. And if Americans are lacking in the latter category, it's going to spell trouble, even if they're strong in the former category. and he thought that the schoolhouse ought to serve as an ideal, basically as an inspiration. And the catalyst that transforms the schoolhouse into the inspiration is going to be the teacher. Coolidge rightfully labeled a teacher as one of the noblest of professions, and that it carries with it a deep sense of responsibility. He was, after all, keep in mind, speaking to the National Education Association. And I strongly agree with his assertion of the nobility of teaching and the responsibility that it carries. There's no substitute for a great teacher. No pun intended there with substitute teacher. But far too often today, a great teacher is becoming the exception and unfortunately isn't the norm. Coolidge boldly stated one of the chief rights of an American citizen is the right to an education. You won't find that explicitly stated in the Constitution, but nevertheless, Coolidge was labeling it as such in 1924. And he went even further, stating that the opportunity to secure an education, that must not only be provided, but it should be made compulsory. I guess he shifted in his speech from minimum government and maximum governance to maybe one of not so minimum government and coercing the individual, which I find interesting. If public education is essential, and if it's a right, as Coolidge argued, then it should be made compulsory. And at that point, then you can see it wasn't a stretch for him to argue that state government and state revenues should be applied toward making sure that the education system is proper and that the state should set the standards and provide the oversight. Now, he did discuss whether it should be, say, state or local governments that drive public education or whether it should be the federal government. And he sort of took a balanced approach, maybe argued both sides of the coin, and he said that you needed both. So first, he recognized that decisions that are made locally or on the state level, they're superior to decisions and policy set by the federal government as a general rule. I guess that's sort of a nod to states' rights. But he also argued that, and posited, frankly, that education, it's such an important issue. It's so large, it looms so large in the national interest, that some states and some local municipalities, they're going to have limited resources and less resources than others, and that the national government, the federal government, should or indeed must have a say in the public education system, which is effectively the idea behind the education department. And it was interesting to read his speech, to see that balancing act that he was trying to perform when it came to individual families driving education decisions, right? State and local governments and their say-so, making sure that the right of education was being granted, and then the federal government playing ultimate arbiter, looking over all the different states and educational institutions to make sure that the national interests in a sound public education system are being protected. As we've seen many times in the real world, that can be a quite messy, volatile, and frustrating effort. Thought you'd enjoy that discussion of President Coolidge's speech regarding public education back in 1924 on the 4th of July, his birthday. Our next topic is going to pivot off the Coolidge linking an educated and knowledgeable citizenry to be fundamental to ensuring sound policy from government. That was one of his key underpinnings of that speech. And that, again, ignorance is not going to be bliss if you want the voters to understand the policies the government is instituting. So let's make a connection to how citizens over time, and perhaps too quickly, have been lulled to sleep into accepting things as normal today. And specifically, I want to discuss withholding tax on our wages. You see, during the time of Calvin Coolidge, there was no withholding tax. You had an annual tax bill if you exceeded a certain income level, and that had to be paid within a specified period of time. But you decided individually how you would save and pay for the tax, and there was no withholding from your paycheck. That changed during World War II because the federal government was desperate for income to finance its war effort. And that brings us to a fascinating individual, Vivian Kellams. And wait till you hear her story. And shout out to Amity Schles, who wrote an excellent piece on Vivian Kellams. Now, how did we get from no withholding tax to a situation today whereby all workers readily accept their wages being garnished to pay taxes as money is earned, and at the same time, all businesses are coerced into being the intermediary and the agent of the federal government when collecting the withholding tax? Businesses and employees, they willingly engage in that behavior today without asking whether it makes sense or if it is in their best interests, and you don't have a choice. It all started, as I said, back during World War II, when the federal government needed to go from an income tax that applied effectively to only high earners to a mass tax where many more people would become taxpayers. And that, of course, wasn't very popular with the citizens, as you can imagine, even with an epic war at hand. So unsurprisingly, in 1942, it was found that fewer than 15% of taxpayers were actually setting aside and saving money to make that year's tax payment. So a revenue train wreck was coming for the federal government, and there was an expensive war that was on. It was an executive at Macy's, the department store giant, who was also a director of the New York Federal Reserve, who came up with an idea: entice voters and taxpayers by announcing that a large share of their past tax obligations would be forgiven if they would agree to withholding a portion of their wages as tax payments on future earnings moving forward. And the specifics that lawmakers approved was a 75% tax forgiveness for 1 year's tax obligation, coupled with 20% withholding on earnings moving forward. And the withholding was marketed as a victory tax, always good at the optics and the labeling. And it started in January of 1943. Before you knew it, employers started to withhold on workers' earnings. And the trade, when you think this through, was a one-time tax forgiveness gift for taxpayers coupled with an everlasting withholding tax burden for taxpayers and employers across a much wider tax base. And that's where Miss Kellams comes into the story. She was a successful businesswoman. Her company manufactured cable grips for bridges and buildings, as well as devices for rehab from broken bones. And a lot of their products were involved in the war effort. And she heard and saw what was going on with the withholding tax maneuvers by Congress. And she announced that her company couldn't afford to pay taxes. She claimed, quote, "I do not have the money, and to raise the amount, I would have to mortgage my house, cash in my war bonds, and go into bankruptcy." So that's from Mrs. Kellams. And she also noted that since her company was manufacturing products for the wartime effort, bankruptcy, that's not going to help America achieve victory. She said that the government should, quote, "abolish at least 2,000 useless, silly federal bureaus and eliminate every worldwide boondoggling project which has no connection with winning the war." That's the words of Mrs. Kellams. She obviously was something else, and you can tell by her statements that there sat a true libertarian. But this was the federal government, constant listeners. The federal government never sleeps. It has infinite resources. So eventually, Kellams had to pay her tax and withhold her employees' wages. And she did so, using her term, with the greatest reluctance. Now, when the war ended, it became clear that withholding tax was going to be permanent. So Kellams launches a campaign aimed at abolishing withholding requirements. Her company stopped the withholding practices and told the Treasury Department in 1948 that no one has the right to take money out of the pay envelope of another person. And she was basically trying to test the legality and constitutionality of withholding. And she was basically asking to be indicted by the federal government to prove her point. Well, she wasn't indicted, but the IRS began to turn the screws on Miss Kellams and her business. By the early 1960s, she sold the company. She blamed overtaxation as the reason, saying to a reporter, "We never have been more prosperous, but when you finish paying taxes, there is no money left." She wrote a book in the middle of her tax battles. The title of the book is Toil, Taxes, and Trouble. And she justified her effort on two reasons, two rationale. One, at the time, the top marginal tax rate was 91%, and thus a heavy burden. But also the second reason was that the process that was mandated, no matter what the effective tax rate was, the process with withholding was highly improper in her view. And I'd love to get my hands on that book. I'll let you know if I track it down soon here. And she made great points. She said, "The one main object of the withholding tax was to lull the taxpayer to sleep, to deceive him that not he, but someone else was paying the tax. If he did feel any resentment, it would be directed at the employer, not the government." Isn't that, boy, that's just echoing Calvin Coolidge, his warning in terms of making sure that the citizenry was educated when it came to policy. in his speech that would have been, what, 20 plus years prior to Mrs. Kellum's statements. In Kellum's words, they ring true, not just for withholding tax, but also for a whole slew of other taxes and the false justifications or attributions as to the cause of it or the need for them. And it won't stop until these citizens wake up and start paying attention. But as Calvin Coolidge pointed out, if the public education system isn't teaching and instructing the citizen how to be aware and awake, then all is for naught. Expect the citizens to accept whatever the government ends up handing them from a policy perspective, along with the bogus justifications. Mrs. Kellum's, she died at age 78 in 1975. And here's a sad note of irony. When she passed away, the government made her heirs pay $265,000 in back taxes. Yeah, the government always gets its money, constant listeners. End of the line. We are approaching for episode 170, Penn State's $700 million football excess at a time where much better priorities exist with the university system. President Coolidge's 1924 speech on the 4th of July regarding public education, the proof forward-looking, and that libertarian anti-withholding tax advocate Vivian Kellum's. Let's close with the final connection. Okay, Mrs. Kellum's, she also ran for office at different points in her career. She lost a U.S. Senate race to Prescott Bush, who was George Bush the first's father, and George Bush is the second's grandfather. And the year that she lost to Prescott Bush was 1956. She garnered only 0.56% of the vote as an independent. The 1956 pop charts was dominated by The King, as in Elvis. And get this, he had the number one song overall for the year, Heartbreak Hotel, and that's where you typically end up when you take on the IRS. And he also claimed the number two spot for the year with Don't Be Cruel, which is what you will end up begging the IRS to do if you pick a fight with them. Yeah, put on some Elvis, pay your taxes, and stay connected to that far middle.